Solitaire Rose Novelcast, After the Fall, Part 4. Derek Coward, who does the Comic Book Noise and all of the other noise podcasts, you can hear his podcast at comicbooknoise.com, does a lot of them. A lot of them are very entertaining. I really like how he sets it up and how, in a lot of ways, it's just turns on a microphone, talks about what's going on, what he likes. Fun stuff to listen to. He has started listening to Novelcast and sent me something about how I should do a bit of a recap for those of you who are coming in late. He told me that earlier today, so I haven't had time to write anything up formally. So, what I'll do to get you caught up. First, if you're new, Solitaire Rose Novelcast is a podcast in which I read the novels that I've written. When each one is complete, it will then be an ebook available on Amazon. I will also take the raw audio of the actual Novelcast itself, remove all of the introductions and the conclusions, and put it together as an audiobook. It's all self-done, it's all self-made, I do it all myself, right here at this desk. Second, each Novelcast will come as a group. After the Fall is one novel. When it's complete, the next one will be Solitaire Rose Novelcast with the next novel. This will continue. I have a lot of novels I need to edit, complete, and prepare. Third, I want to thank everybody who has been telling other people about the Novelcast. It's a different idea for me. Normally I do a comic book podcast over at Crazy Comics and Stories, but this is different, and there's going to be a lot of different things coming next year as well, so there's a reason I call it the Solitaire Rose Podcast Radio Network. So, four, the Novelcast for After the Fall. The first three episodes completed the first chapter in which we have introduced our characters and introduced the world. We are now in a world 5 years after civilization has fallen. Zombies exist, and human beings seem to be scattered. Our characters all are very separated, and we ended with Ray escaping from an army base because he just couldn't stand being enclosed any longer. That is where we ended chapter one. We pick up with an interlude telling a little about what happened before the fall of civilization. Interlude one. 6 years ago. 5 minutes to air, Reverend Robinson, came the voice through the door of his dressing room. Will Robinson looked at himself in the mirror and marveled at the good work his makeup people had done. He was getting old, but he still had a message to preach to the good people of the United States. It was too bad only the faithful listened, despite him being able to keep his news program on the Family Channel, even after it was sold to Fox, and then Disney. He grabbed his papers off the makeup desk and got up. Mary, the very sweet makeup girl, looked at him, her eyes about to erupt in tears. He looked at the clock, knowing he didn't have much time left, but unable to leave a girl in pain. "What's wrong, child?" She grabbed his hand. "It's the end of the world, isn't it? I thought we'd be ascending to heaven if the world ended. That's what everyone told me, but I'm still here. What have I done wrong? Didn't I love and trust Jesus enough?" Will smiled, patting her hand. "The fact that we are still here proves that this isn't the end of the world. We'll get through this. God has protected us so far, and he'll protect us now. He gave us a very wise leader in the Vice President, and the President will do whatever he's told. This too shall pass." She smiled through her tears and said, "Thank you." He patted her on the shoulder, glad to have wrapped it up without having to worry about the time, and said, "Go with God," as he left the room and started down the hall, his notes clutched in his hand. As he went down the hallway, people were giving him information about the show coming up. He nodded and smiled, moving quickly and ignoring it all. Any information this close to airtime wouldn't affect anything he said. That sort of thing was all in the hands of the anchors. That's what they were paid for. He came onto the set, and the two anchors were going over their final preparations before airtime. Carmen, the latest pretty blonde who worked hard for the tiny pay he gave to his workers on the idea that she was going to save the world. He knew that her job was to look beautiful on camera and not misreading the names of world leaders. She saw him and smiled. He waved at her and hoped she wouldn't mispronounce the leader of Iran's name again. It made them look like a bunch of idiots. The main anchorman, Dave, wasn't paying attention to anyone on the set, but was instead reading over the headlines he was going to be delivering. Dave was the latest of the men he'd hired straight out of college to try and get someone, anyone, that one of the legitimate news organizations would hire to give his organization a touch of respectability. All of the previous anchors had moved from being newsreaders to evangelical preachers, seeing that the money there was better than being the overnight person on CNN's headline news service. Just once, he wished they would look beyond the short-term game and look at the long-term. Commentators and cable news experts made more money by dictating a book to a ghostwriter than he himself had made in years of going church to church and selling books. His dad tried to hammer that home when he went into preaching instead of politics. He didn't listen and had lost out on both the news career he wanted and the political one he had tried for. No matter how he tried to frame it, people saw him as a guy on TV who asked for money. A man who talked about and to God. So he turned it to his advantage. He invested in blood diamonds and other mining in African countries run by dictators. He could fly planes into those countries filled with Bibles, and fly them out filled with semi-legal precious metal and jewels, and all under the cover of charity and religion. And now, as one of the worst crises in the history of the U.S. was hitting, he had to talk again about the Christian perspective instead of his own. Sitting less than 50 feet from him were two people who'd bought into it completely, and he didn't have the guts to tell them what he really thought. He couldn't even tell the world what he really thought, because if he did, ABC would yank his show and replace it with another hour of fucking Power Ranger reruns or barely disguised soap operas about teenagers sleeping with each other. He sat going over his notes as the anchors gave update on the crises. He only heard bits and pieces of it that he hadn't heard yet. The president was giving most of his power to the vice president and the secretary of defense because he was needed to bolster the hopes of the American people. Most of the third world countries had already fallen to the monsters, and most of Russia was said to be dark. Europe was arming citizens to protect themselves, which they wouldn't have had to do if they hadn't taken away everybody's guns after World War II. Here in the U.S., the military had taken to the street, but in most of the cities they were losing, and losing fast. The dead outnumbered the living, and the shelters that had been set up for people to go to were the first places the zombies, yes, they were finally being called zombies, were attacking. People were to leave the cities, find secure buildings, or ask their local National Guard for help in securing their homes. Since it was February, the zombie activity was mainly in the southern states, where people were pretty well armed anyway. A lot of people were trying to go north, but Canada had closed its border and was posting troops with shoot-to-kill orders. Reports were that Mexico was in serious trouble, and most American experts believed they wouldn't last the week. Some reports were coming from the remote areas of Mexico that people were dying in cataclysmic numbers, their homes not secure enough. No help from the Mexican military arrived. No one knew for sure, since communication in all but the areas closest to the U.S. were dead. Unlike the border with Canada, people were flowing across the border into the U.S. with the military too busy trying to kill the dead than worry about where the living were. The blonde female anchor, whose name he couldn't remember now, turned to him and said, "And with words of hope and inspiration, here is Will Robinson." "Thank you," he said, and then stared into the camera the way he'd learned over the years. It wasn't a big piece of equipment with a glowing red light on the top. It was an elderly woman in his mind who was scared to go outside and wanted to know that everything would be all right if people would just listen to him and believe what he told them. "I have been asked if these are the end times, and if this is what Revelation talked about when it talks about the end of the world. The newly dead are rising and attacking the living. It was a few when it started, in remote areas of the South, mostly near army bases. However, over the past 2 months, it has grown to encompass the whole world. Bodies have to be burned instead of buried. People are being attacked. Cities are no longer safe. It's a horrifying, horrifying thing we have to deal with, and as the spring comes, the dead will move north, where people are moving to get away from the horror. but this is not the end of the world. If it were the end of the world, I wouldn't be here. I would have been brought up to heaven in the rapture that was promised to us by our Lord Jesus. When he spoke to us through his holy word and said that those of us who were saved would not have to be here for the 1,000 years that Satan would have the earth. So no, this is not the end of the world. It does show that God has lifted the protection of our country. God has turned his back on the United States just as the United States has turned its back on God, because we allowed the homosexuals, the feminists, the liberals, the Democrats, and the Satanists who run TV stations and radio stations and movie studios to take over our culture. God has let us know that we need to turn back to him by allowing demonic possession of the dead. Satan is working in our world, and he is the one who is bringing the dead back to life to kill people. Only through our trust in God and our faith in the Vice President's truthful convictions will we be able to defeat this horde of demons who are set to overtake the U.S. just as they have the countries that have never known God. Join me now as I pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we ask for your protection, again, to cast Satan out of the bodies of our deceased loved ones. We know that you are giving us a sign, and we will heed it. We will drive out the heathens, the unbelievers, the liberals, and the sodomites who have caused you to turn your back on us so that you can protect us again. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. He heard the other people in the studio say amen when he was done, and he saw the red light on top of the camera go dark. He was done. He realized he hadn't looked at his notes once, which had Bible verses he had wanted to use to bolster his argument. Now they would have to go on the website. He sat quietly as they planned the rest of the show, checking that the commercials were running as long as needed and fixing people's makeup. Powerful, powerful stuff, the male anchor said, and he nodded. He no longer even cared what anyone else thought. Mexico had fallen to the dead. Cities were emptying out. May not have been the end of the world, but it was close enough. As he got up, he wondered if the Vice President would allow him and his family to join them in the secluded bunker they would be retreating to in the next few days. The President? He would stay in the White House. The Texan was just a figurehead anyway, set up to be in the ads and make their hardline agenda seem folksy and almost sweet. Bastard better let him in after he'd been carrying the burden of delivering the religious vote. They owed him, and he was going to collect. Chapter 2. Eddie's memory was spotty at best, but for a zombie, it was amazing he had a memory at all. There was a valid scientific explanation for what had happened over time. He was one of the first bodies infected with the virus that was able to reanimate the dead. As such, the virus first mutated to be highly infectious and able to use flesh to replenish the body that it used as a host. However, it had been slowly mutating in Eddie's body for 5 years, to the point where it mimicked the neural pathways of his brain and other bodily functions that allowed for breathing and speech. In some ways, it was symbiotic, using Eddie's body as a host. None of this mattered to Eddie, if he would have been able to understand it anyway. He had been like so many of the others, a shambling dead body craving the flesh of the living, lapsing into a kind of hibernation when it wasn't available. It was during this hibernation that the virus would mutate, change, and adapt. He had flashes of memory when he would sense there was flesh nearby, either animal or human, and come out of the coma. He wasn't able to tell how long he'd been able to think and remember. It had come to him in bits and pieces over a long period of time, though. At first he had wandered the countryside, sometimes with other zombies who weren't able to think or remember, but mostly he would hunt humans. He learned that most of them were lazy about their security. In the years since the fall, most people had gathered together in small communities or had put together secure houses, but most of them just had latches keeping their fences in place since the others couldn't use tools. He could. Better than most of the people in the houses. He was able to clearly recall the first group of people that he was able to attack and kill in their sleep. He had put together enough ability to think to realize that if he was quiet, if he knew how to open their gate instead of just pounding on the fence, he would be able to get what he needed, living flesh. Before he could talk and reason, he just moaned. The brain knew it had the ability to talk, but the skills and connections were gone. That was a problem. Much like a baby learning to speak, the other living dead knew they could make sound, but they didn't know what sounds to make, or when not to make sound. As he went through the house, he kept quiet, killing them quickly and moving on to the next room. The last person in the house was a teenage boy, who woke up due to the sound of Eddie opening the door to his room and knocking over some pile of books or other stuff stacked too close to the door. The teenager woke up and saw him, reached for his weapon, and then Eddie talked. He didn't remember what he said, but the fact that he could talk caused the teenager to hesitate just long enough. All of the people in that house were not infected by the same virus that had created him. All of the people in that house were infected by the same virus that had created him. So 6 hours later, they rose and walked, looking for flesh to eat. They couldn't speak yet, but were simply the walking dead. It would take years before the virus in their bodies had twisted and adapted the flesh to work the way the virus had changed Eddie. Most wouldn't make it, but maybe a few would. Eddie was the only one he knew of. Over time, he realized if he were hurt or damaged, eating the flesh of the living would make the pain go away and somehow make the damage heal itself. The first actual memory he had in this second life was that of the stiffness in his arms and legs fading as he devoured some screaming man alive. The pain faded quickly as he ate, but as he searched for more, the pain would come back after a day or two. Early on, he also knew that the moaning came back, as each step or movement was agony, only cured by eating flesh. The morning after Ray had been able to sneak out of the army base, Eddie had found another home with complacent people. He'd simply taken the latch off their fence, quietly broken a window to get into the house before the sun came up. He walked through the house, trying to understand the people who were there. There were old pictures on the wall, paintings from before the fall. One showed quiet people in a field harvesting grain. One was Jesus as a bearded white man looking at the sky and enveloped in light. One was a poster in a frame that had been a movie that had come out during World War II, when people felt they were fighting against the greatest evil to walk the earth. The living room was a place filled with books, bullets, and scattered pillows and blankets. No one was there, so Eddie crept into the kitchen, which had a table, 3 chairs, dried foodstuff, and an old oven that could have a fire burning inside it to heat the surface. There was a pile of wood next to the oven. He grabbed a particularly heavy hunk of split wood and carried it as he went upstairs to the bedrooms. At the top of the hardwood stairs was a door to his right, a hallway leading to 2 other doorways on his left, and weapons. Hanging on the wall were a shotgun, a pair of pistols, and boxes of ammo strewed about on the floor. He silently unloaded them and hung them back up, making sure none of the house's inhabitants had heard him. He moved quietly and quickly, unlike the other walking dead. Eddie was able to move with stealth, and if not for his complexion and the look of rigor on his face, could have passed for a normal human in the dark. His clothes weren't tattered. A black pocket t-shirt, loose blue jeans held up by a black leather belt, and shoes he'd taken from a victim 3 months previously because he felt that walking around barefoot was too damaging. He didn't feel pain immediately when his body was damaged, but instead the virus would create a kind of pain that let him know more flesh was needed. He passed back down the hall. A shaft of rising sunlight, shining through one of the doors that had been left ajar, fell over his face as he peered into the room, looking at 2 children sleeping there. He continued to the door he had passed by, the one that had been on his right at the top of the stairs, and touched the handle. Unlocked. All too easy. Once dead fingers grabbed the door handle. Unable to feel the handle the way a live person would through a series of nerves, but instead communicated by a system of viral communication that it would have taken scientists years to comprehend. The door was slowly pushed open, and he could smell the person inside, asleep. The carbon dioxide they were expelling with every breath smelled to him the way a charbroiled steak would smell to a hungry farmhand. He saw the person on the bed, unable to tell if they were male or female, but not caring. The virus communicated pain to his brain. The virus communicated pain to his brain, and it was hard not to simply rush forward and kill the pain with flesh. However, in his functioning brain, he was able to reason that if he did so, and the person made any noise at all, the other people in the house would be alerted and attack him. The attack would possibly damage his body to the point where he wouldn't be able to repair it easily. They outnumbered him. They had guns and fire. No. He had to be quiet and take them out, one at a time. The others of his kind would have burst into the house full of noise and strength. They might have been able to attack 1 or 2, but alone, they were not smart enough to survive. Eddie was smart enough. He thought back to a time when he was damaged so badly, it took months of hunting to get enough flesh to pull himself back together completely. Of course, if they were competent, that might be able to destroy his brain, killing him. Instead, he crept forward and gazed at the sleeping person in the dark. The bedroom had no windows, and the door had a crudely built section that would allow for a brace to be placed on it, making the door nearly impregnable from the other side. This had been the safe room at one point, but now it had been converted to a bedroom. The room was relatively uncluttered, with cardboard boxes piled in one corner and a dresser against the wall. There was also a small basket with discarded clothes. A woman, young-looking, was laying on her side on the bed, pushed against the wall against the door. She was breathing slowly in her sleep. It did not look like she had disturbed the bed in her sleep. She had a gun lying on the floor next to her bed. She was dressed in a t-shirt similar to his. A thin sheet covered the rest of her body. Her hair was dirty blonde and cut very short. Maybe somewhere in the deep recesses of his brain, some of the old lust from when he was alive stirred. However, the only lust he was aware of feeling was for the flesh. The pain hadn't started, but it tickled. The desire was always there. The wood in his hand went up, and then quickly crashed down on her head, making a loud, sudden thump. Her body convulsed twice, and then was still. Eddie paused, waiting to see if the noise had awoken anyone, and when there was no sound or movement, he knelt by the bed, put the hunk of wood on the floor, and fed. When he was done feeding, he sat by the bed a second longer and closed his eyes, feeling something as close to bliss as he possibly could. The flesh entered his body, and instead of traveling through a digestive system as his body used to be set up for, the flesh was torn apart by the virus, somehow, and was being broken down as he was eating it. He picked up the gun and emptied the bullets from it. He held them in his hand, six small metal things, round at one end, flat at the other. He lay them around her head, crushed there on the pillow, in a circle. It was an offering of some kind. He picked up the wood and went back down the hall, past the room with the two children, to the door at the end of the hallway. There was an instinct to grab one of the guns off the wall, load it up, and take care of whoever was behind the door, but he knew that if he shot the person, the others would wake up. He was still outnumbered, and he had a plan. He didn't want the children he'd seen to wake up just yet. The door was unlocked, and inside was a single man, older than the woman in the other room had been. His hair was gray, and he had a short, nicely trimmed beard. He was asleep on his back, wearing a flannel shirt, with a gun by his side. Eddie entered the room. This one, with two large dressers, a gun cabinet, and boxes overflowing with books and magazines. The bed was in the center of the room, and flanked by two windows that had no glass in them, long ago broken or shot out. He crept quietly to the bed, and pulled the gun out of the man's light grip, putting it softly on the floor. He could have just bashed the man's head in, as he had with the younger woman, but he wasn't as hungry now. He was in search of something else, something less primal but just as important as the flesh. He wanted fear. He knew that he was stronger than most humans, partly because he didn't feel pain, and partly because the virus had made his flesh harder. That's why the others moved so slowly. He stood over the bed for just a moment, savoring the feeling of having his prey so totally at his mercy. His face twitched into a grisly parody of a smile, and he paused, wishing the moment would last forever. Then, with a speed that would have prevented any sort of defense, he grabbed the man by the throat. Eyes snapped open and a face filled with realization and fear. He struggled by grabbing at Eddie's arms, and then tried kicking as Eddie lifted him off the bed to stand next to him. "Fighting," Eddie said, watching the horror in the man's eyes grow as he realized what he was seeing and hearing. Eddie's voice didn't sound quite human, as it went over resurrected vocal cords that weren't used to having air pass through and around them. The only time Eddie really needed to breathe was when he wanted to talk. His voice was deep, and almost had an echo, as he had two different vocal cord structures that were related. When he spoke, there was also an unintended rumble, that was like having the bass of a stereo turned up all the way. "I like it when people do that. Makes it more of a sport. Problem is, you don't know the fight is already over." The man started to gasp for air and was grabbing and tearing at Eddie's hand. Behind him, he heard something going on. Must have been the two children waking up. Eddie had made a lot of noise. He smiled, looking into the man's eyes and trying to figure out what he was thinking. He heard footsteps behind him and turned rapidly, still holding onto the man's throat and squeezing a little more. He saw the two children who had been sleeping holding the guns from the hallway on him. "You don't want to shoot me," Eddie said calmly. "You might miss me and hit dear old Dad. And if you don't kill me right off, I'll snap his neck before you can reload." One of the children held the gun out strongly. The other one was more tentative. They were in loosely fitting shirts and jeans, and their hair was cut short. He had no idea if they were boys or girls. Not that it really mattered anymore. They stood there for a second, his squeezing a bit harder until the man's face started to turn a dark red. He kept pulling at Eddie's hands, trying to wheeze something through his crushed throat. Eddie loosened his grip so he could give a final message to the children, and the man was able to get out. "Run!" between gasps for air. The child who'd been holding the gun strongly turned and ran without looking back, but the one who'd been holding the gun less confidently changed their stance and aimed for Eddie's head. Eddie smiled and said, "Better make it good. You've only got one shot." The child pulled the trigger and nothing happened. "Guess you don't even have that," Eddie said, and squeezed as hard as he could, causing the man's neck to be crushed within his grasp. Blood splashed, and the man's body fell to the floor. The child who had stayed started to move, but Eddie leaped to the door and grabbed the child. He held the child's arms at its side as he pulled it face to face with him. The child had a single tear running down its face as Eddie said, "I don't play fair. Nothing personal. It's just hunting." After he had fed, he went downstairs and started a fire in the wood next to the oven. He didn't hurry as he left the house, and paused to watch it burn. He wasn't in any hurry at all, since he wouldn't need to feed again for days, giving him long enough to hunt down the other child who got away. Besides, hunting would give him something to do for the rest of the week. Ray woke with a start, confused by being in the dark and wondering where his bed had gone. He'd barricaded himself in a mobile home he'd found after walking for over 24 hours straight. He'd wanted to get as far away from the base as he could in case they sent anyone out to look for him. No one had ever been searched for before, but better safe than dead, he had figured. There was another part of him that thought that he had done so because if he stopped during that first day, he may turn around and go back. Since he crawled under the fence, there'd been no going back. It was one of those things your head knows, but your heart doesn't completely believe. He dreamed about going home and being welcomed by the other soldiers. In his dream, they hailed him as a hero. Then both Susan and Jen had wanted to welcome him back in a more personal way. It had made sense when he was dreaming, but now it faded from his mind. Dim sunlight came in through the few dirty windows that had not been broken out, and he peeked around the plywood they nailed over the ones that were. He couldn't tell by looking if it was early morning or twilight, but it didn't matter. When he'd secured the small metal home, the sun had been out, but by the time he collapsed into sleep, he wasn't really sure when it was. He had a vague memory of it being nighttime, but sleep had dulled his senses. Having to stay up and walk so long had blurred his thinking. He grabbed his backpack after going through the 70x12 metal box to make sure he was still alone, and grabbed an MRE. His canteen was full, and he drank greedily from it as he tore open the plastic-encased food. He wolfed down the food, barely tasting it as he sucked it from its plastic case. He threw the garbage onto the floor and opened the crackers and squeezed the peanut butter onto them and ate that slower. His immediate hunger sated. He reached into his backpack and pulled out the small field radio he'd taken. It was a radio that would work for up to 12 hours using the charge from a small crank on the side. It was primarily made for third world countries, but as the fall was occurring, everyone in the U.S. military was given one. They weren't used after the fall, since the main bases were no longer broadcasting on them. Orders were that they were to consider themselves separate entities until they heard from the commander-in-chief. That order never came. He turned the crank until the gauge on the radio showed it was at full charge and stopped. Did he really want to hear if they were trying to contact him? Would he respond? If he did, what could he say? As the sunlight started to get brighter, he realized that if he didn't, he'd spend the rest of his day wondering. Switch was pressed and the radio hummed quietly to life. It was weird hearing static, since he hadn't heard it in months, possibly years. It was a dull noise that seemed utterly unnatural, filled with the memory of electricity and activity. He remembered radio stations playing the same songs all the time and telling you that they were about to play your favorite hits. Others had people calling in to complain about things that made them feel weak and small. He hadn't paid much attention to radio when it was around him all the time, and he actually enjoyed the quiet once it went away. It was something people got confused by. They'd ask him what kind of music he liked, and he'd say, "None, really." They'd stammer about how everyone liked music, and he'd just stare at them, dead-eyed, until they changed the subject, or more likely, start going on and on about the music they liked, as if it defined them as human beings. He turned the frequency dial to the assigned frequency for his base, and waited, not realizing he was holding his breath. Nothing. He propped it up on the floor next to him, and finished his peanut butter crackers. He tore open the brownie and actually slowed down enough to taste it as he ate. It was really kind of a chocolate paste, but it was sweet, thick, and tasted good. He tore open the package to lick the last of the chocolate off of it when the radio crackled to life. "Echo Base to Baker 3. Echo Base to Baker 3. Please come in." They were calling for him. He didn't know whether to be happy or scared. "This is Echo Base calling for Baker 3. Baker 3, please come in." There probably wasn't a person in range with a radio of this type, let alone tuned to that frequency, or would know who he was. Yet the base kept using code for security reasons. If he had any doubts about leaving, they were immediately erased. "Echo Base to Baker 3. Echo Base to Baker 3. This is an urgent message for Baker 3. He picked up the radio and almost immediately clicked the talk button, but paused. What could be urgent? The radio was shaped like a small cell phone with an extra speaker in the back. There was a switch if the person using the radio wanted privacy and activated the earphone speaker, but it also made it easier to use. He waited a bit longer, weighing the options in his head and wondering if he should answer. There wasn't a way they could triangulate to find him from inside the base, and there really wasn't anything they could say to convince him to come back. What would be the point? Curiosity? That was the only reason to answer. And apparently, that was enough as he switched the speaker to the earpiece only and said, "This is Baker 3. Go ahead." Over. There was a pause and a different voice came on. "Baker 3, confirm your identity via password." Jesus fucking God, he thought. Why would anybody want to pretend they were Baker 3? The passwords were changed monthly and used when identity was in doubt. They were supposed to use them when they relieved each other from guard duty, but within 3 months of the fall, they were routinely ignored by the men and were only used in the monthly briefing and in the minds of Bradley, the commanding officer. He could turn off the radio now and be done with it. They would know that he was alive, which had to be the reason they were trying to contact him. He could, but he didn't. Baker 3 responding, "Wally Gator. Repeat, Wally Gator." Password confirmed. He finally recognized the voice as that of the CO. Why the hell was he sitting at the radio room to see if they could get in touch with him? "Report your position and condition." "My condition is fine, but I will not report my position." The radio was silent for another long pause. Then the voice came back on. "Are you refusing orders, soldier?" "Yes, sir. I do not think it would be in my best interest to give my location. I will confirm that I am not on base property and will not be returning to the base, sir." "Would you care to explain that, Baker 3? There is someone here other than myself who is looking for some answers, and I said what I would get them for her." Shit. Susan. He didn't want to hurt her, but there was no way not to, he guessed. He looked out the window and saw the sun getting brighter. If he wanted to get some decent distance that day, he would have to get moving soon. He pressed the transmit button again and said, "I understand that, sir. I was unable to remain on the base in a state of lockdown. Not to disparage the base or any of the personnel, but I feel that it is not an acceptable plan to aid the country's reconstruction or to face the enemy. I think it is important to see if the other bases have personnel, what their plans of action are, and when we will quit hiding like rabbits in cages, sir. Respectfully." A longer pause. He took the opportunity to start packing his gear into his backpack and preparing to leave. By the time he had put away his field bedding and was checking his weapons, the radio crackled to life again. "I have sent all other personnel from the room, Baker 3, because you need to know some facts. There are no other bases. Communication went down with them 3 years ago, and when we sent scouts on private missions, they did not return. There is nothing out there. Do you understand that? Nothing is left. There are groups here and there that are holding on, but eventually they will fall as well. They don't have the discipline or dedication to maintain safety. Entropy is one, soldier. we're the only hope left, and that isn't a whole lot of hope. I understand what you're feeling, but you're chasing a fantasy. The radios have been silent for 3 years. No one is talking because no one can. I can bring you back in, but you have to come back on your own, and today. I can't keep a lid on this much longer, and if you don't return soon, my hands are tied. Ray didn't answer. What could he say? He looked at his guns on the stained and ruined carpet, and then to the window. Outside, the grass was waist high, waving in the wind. Birds flew by, and in the distance were trees by the bank of a small river. Ray? Female voice came from the radio. Susan. Ray, I know things haven't been good for a while. I know you've been restless and upset, and I'm sorry. I'll change. The voice was broken with sobs. I swear to God, I'll change. He grabbed the radio and pushed the transmit button. Susan, don't blame yourself. I couldn't stay trapped in a cage anymore. It was a hamster running around in that cage. You can love other hamsters in the cage, but at night you're still in a cage. Maybe there isn't anything out here. If that's true, then I'll have to decide what to do then, but I had to get out of the cage. Better to die a free man by a river than in a cage as an old man. I know you don't understand this, but it's how I had to do it. I had to get out of that place before my mind snapped. He turned the radio off before he could possibly hear a reply, and tossed it against the wall as hard as he could. It hit with a loud crack and shattered the wood paneling lodged in the wall. He slumped against the wall and slowly slid down, wanting to cry more than he wanted anything in his life, but unable to do anything more than just cover his eyes and breathe deeply. He sat there, his head between his knees, breathing slowly, wondering what kind of madness he had been infected by to leave that place and not want to go back, to trade a warm bed and a warmer woman for an abandoned mobile home that smelled like dead animals. He was so lost in his own thoughts that he didn't hear the door at the end of the hallway come open. The stained shag carpet softened the footsteps in the hallway, and Ray wasn't listening anyway. He was too consumed with his thoughts and wondering just what the hell he would do now. He didn't see the female zombie until it had shambled out of the hallway and was moving toward him. He saw it out of the corner of his eye and went to grab his guns on the floor, but the zombie had already gotten close enough that he would not have time to pick them up, aim, and fire before it was on him. Ray rolled from his sitting position into what must have been the kitchen at the front of the mobile home and looked rapidly around for a weapon of any kind. The furniture had long ago been removed from the house, as had the appliances, except for the stove. Most of the cabinet doors had long ago broken off, and the drawers under the counters were gone as well. He kicked quickly at the inside of one of the cabinets and heard the wood shatter. He reached in and pulled out a short, jagged piece of wood just as the zombie was close enough to reach for him. He kicked again, this time at the zombie's leg. He heard a crack as he connected, not unlike he had heard from the shattering of the wood, and the zombie fell to the ground next to him. He was up quickly and kicked again, aiming at the head of the creature. He hit with a satisfying crunch, and the zombie rolled to the far wall. It was still trying to get up when he used the wood as a spike and jammed it into the zombie's head. No sound came from the open mouth. No shock entered its eyes. No final cry of any kind as a living human would do if it were killed. The zombie just stopped and crumpled as if it were held up by strings that were quickly cut. Some sort of black liquid poured out of the wound he had made in its head. He knew he had searched the tin shack before bedding down, so they must have gotten in through one of the windows. He had little time to think about it. He looked toward the hallway, and seeing three more lumbering toward him, could only mutter, "Shit!" as he ran through his options quickly. It was probably smartest to bolt outside, but his guns, food, and other equipment were in the living room. He might get away if he ran, but without his equipment, he wouldn't be running very long. He pulled the 3-foot shaft of broken wood from the head of the female zombie, and winced as it made wet, soft sounds while coming out. He felt his full stomach do a slow roll as he felt the black liquid ooze down onto his hand. It wasn't warm like blood. It was more like a thick oil at room temperature. There were two male zombies and one female, with the two males leading the way. They were moving toward him, mouths agape and arms outstretched. He held the wood like a baseball bat, holding his ground. He hoped he could knock them down and out of the way before they overwhelmed him. If he could just get past them, he'd be able to get to his guns. If he could pull that off, he would have a good chance. The first two were side by side as they got close enough for him to hit, and he swung at the one on the right as hard as he could, connecting with its head. He felt the wood break and heard a loud crack as he connected, but before he could realize he'd broken his weapon, the other had grabbed him and was pulling his arm toward its mouth. He took the broken shaft of wood and jammed it into the zombie's mouth with his free hand. He could feel it dig into the soft flesh and stick. He didn't even try to pull it out as he made a quick note of the woman zombie coming closer to him. The one he'd hit in the head was on the floor struggling to get up, and the other one was trying to pull the shaft of wood out of its mouth. He must have missed the brain. He kicked the approaching female zombie in the stomach, trying to knock it down. "Thank God for army timing," he said as he kicked the female again, knocking it down and clearing a path to his guns. He moved quickly, not looking behind him until he felt something grab his ankle. The next thing he knew, he'd fallen face first onto the floor and was slightly dazed. The hand on his ankle started pulling him, and he shook off the shock. It was the female pulling him toward her. The other two were recovering as well. He kicked hard at the female's head rapidly, over and over, his heavy army boot connecting with a sick thud each time. When she let go, he was able to scramble backward out of her reach and grasp. The one he had knocked down had gotten up and was moving toward him again, while the one with the wood jammed in its mouth was still trying to pull it free. It was almost morbidly fascinating to see him pull it free, bit by bit, with sounds that would have made him sick if he didn't have so much going on around him. He spun over onto his hands and knees and pushed himself toward his guns. They were just barely out of reach when he was grabbed again by the ankle. It was a male zombie this time, and it was pulling at him again, lifting the leg it had in its hands high in the air. And the last zombie had finally pulled the wood free and was spewing black liquid from its mouth, making it look like it had a mouth full of bile and was spilling it on its face and shirt. He planted his free foot on the ground and rose to almost a full standing position, still facing away from the zombie that had his ankle. It squeezed, and he could feel the bones in his ankle sliding against each other. The strength of the zombie was incredible. He had forgotten just how strong the damn things were. He hopped a couple of times to try and work his ankle free a bit, gritting his teeth against the pain. No good. He hopped one last time and then used the momentum he had built up to spin around and kick the zombie in the face with his free foot. It loosened the grip enough that he broke free and fell to the ground right next to his two pistols. He grabbed the both of them, one in each hand, and started firing, headshots only. He fired until the clips were empty and the zombies were a crumpled mass of dead flesh on the floor. He quickly grabbed his rifle and was up, looking down the hallway. The door next to what would have been a bedroom door was wide open, a way for them to have gotten in. He crept down the hallway, pausing in each bedroom to make sure there was nothing there. He shut the door and locked it after seeing it hadn't been forced open. The plywood over a large broken window in the bedroom had been shoved onto the floor. He'd made a stupid mistake by trusting a repair job that had probably been done 5 years before, one that came close to costing him his life. It could have been far worse if they would have come in while he was sleeping. As he walked back down the hallway, he realized the adrenaline had kept his ankle from hurting, but now it was almost crippling in the amount of pain he was feeling. He sat next to his backpack and made sure that the zombies hadn't broken the skin. Standing up gently and checking out the windows, he made sure there were no more zombies on their way. Relatively sure the coast was clear, he took off his boot and checked the ankle closer. He could tell that nothing was broken, but it was starting to swell a bit, making it hard to get the boot back on. He looked over at the four zombies in the living room and said, "Better figure out how to get the swelling down. Not spending the night with you staring at me. I have enough shitty dreams." He had a field first aid kit, but the only thing he could really do was wrap the ankle and hope it wasn't a serious injury. He wrapped it as tight as he could stand, and then started to repack his kit. He did it with quiet efficiency, making sure everything got packed up and put away. Everything but the radio, which was still lodged in the wall. He stood gingerly and tested the ankle. It still hurt, but not so bad he couldn't get around. This mobile home was no good, and while he might not get very far, he had to get a couple of miles away from it, if for no other reason than to get away from the faces of the dead laying on the floor. He looked back at them. One with a crushed head still oozing black fluid onto the carpet, two others with bullet holes in their heads, and the last one still flowing black fluid out of its mouth where he had jammed his weapon. He reached into his pack and pulled out a disposable alcohol washcloth and wiped down his hands, face, and any other exposed skin. The last thing he wanted was that fluid on him in any way when he ate, or even if it got into his mouth from sweating. He shuddered thinking about it, tossing the used cloth onto the closest zombie's face, trying to cover it up. He reloaded his pistols, put them back in his side holsters. Only one thing left, and he stared at it. The radio, sticking out of the tacky wood paneling. Why bother taking it? That was the question he asked himself. He didn't want to talk to the base anymore. There wasn't anybody else around. At least that's what they'd told him. It was a piece of equipment that was just taking up space and weight. He pulled the radio out of the wall and looked at it, then quickly turned it on. It crackled with static, and he knew he couldn't leave it behind with the excuse that it was broken. He went to turn it off and shove it in his backpack when he heard it crackle to life. Baker 3, come in. This is Rogue. Rogue wasn't a name that anyone at the base would have used. He didn't recognize the voice either. He knew everyone at the base. He put the radio next to his ear and triggered the transmit switch. Rogue, this is Baker 3. Can you move to a different frequency? He didn't want the base listening to him, which it was sure to be doing. Baker 3, I can. If you were worried about unauthorized listeners, we could talk at a later time. As any delay would be like days, we should not talk again for another 2 days. Clever, he thought, but not clever enough. What sort of code could they use to confuse anyone else who could be listening? Understood, Rogue, but that delay would not get rid of prying ears. Then we will have to talk again at a later date, Baker 3. Remember that God gave his only son for us to be free. And the radio went dead. If the base was listening, they weren't responding. But what was Rogue saying? Was he one of the Jesus freaks who had broadcast on the radio saying that this was the end of the world? The last broadcasts were religious ones, as anyone with any sense left as the fall was occurring. The telepreachers wanted to hold on until the last minute, trying to pray the zombies away. He remembered one broadcast where the people in the studio were reading the Bible over the air as the zombies broke in, and it hit him. That was the code. He was quoting a Bible verse, John 3:16. The verse that people used to use at football games on poster board to try and get people to get into religion. That was the frequency, but which book of the Bible was John? He tried to remember, but instead decided it was pointless. There was no way he could remember. The only thing to do was to go to every frequency that ended with 316. He would move the frequency dial and say, "This is Baker 3, Rogue, are you there?" Wait a moment, repeat, then move the dial up a click. When he got to the third time, he finally got a response. "This is Rogue. Glad you could find me." Ray smiled, really smiled, and felt good for the first time in a while. "Glad I could find you too, Rogue. Baker 3 was my name on the Army base. I'd rather be called Ray." "So that was an Army base you were talking to?" "I was sure they had all gone dark. I listen on a scanner from time to time, looking for conversations. My name is Marcus. I'm in southern Iowa, holed up in an old farmhouse. What is your location?" "Arkansas, about 20 miles from the old Army training base. I'm headed north. Maybe I can make that my destination." There was silence for a bit, long enough to let Ray know that what he'd said had hit a nerve with whoever Marcus was. The reply came just as he was ready to give up and head out. "That might be a good idea. It's been quiet around here, and maybe you could stop on your way to get supplies and trade information." "What is your destination?" Ray smiled again. "I have absolutely no idea. Right now, it's somewhere in southern Iowa, I think." I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for giving Novelcast a try. And I want to thank the people who are spreading the word. Please, get the word out. Let more people know about this. If you enjoy it, let me know, but also let your friends know. The more it grows, the more we can do. I also want to thank Derek Coward again for letting people know about the Novelcast. I want to thank Kat Rocha for telling people about the Novelcast. She is the editor-in-chief over at 01 Publishing, publishers of World War Kaiju, Whispers in the Abyss Volume 1 and 2, and the upcoming Case File Arkham. Really good stuff coming from 01 Publishing. They've got a lot coming out over the next year or two. I think you're going to be excited about it. And now, Solitaire Rose Podcast Radio Network News. First, Crazy Comics and Stories has officially added Jen Wicked as one of the people involved. She will miss an episode every now and then, but she's just as much a part of the show as myself and Joe. The Solitaire Rose solo podcast, we just had another Jack Kirby episode where myself and Mark Wise, who's from the Comic Bros podcast at comicbrospodcast.com, went over probably the most famous Fantastic Four story there is, Fantastic Four number 51 by Jack Kirby and Stan Lee, This Man, This Monster. We go through it, DVD commentary. We also have a couple more episodes of the Falcon audio that we recorded, but also I will be at the Holiday Geek Expo in Bloomington, December 5th and 6th, the first weekend of December. We'll be setting up our table there. We'll be interviewing people. We'll be talking about the podcast. And if you're in the area, come on down. They're going to be selling all kinds of stuff that us nerdy folk will like. And also, you get to talk to me. You get to talk to Joe. There will be other people there. It's going to be a lot of fun. Over 2016, we're going to be going to a lot of conventions. We're going to be setting up, doing the podcasting there. We're even looking into maybe doing some live podcasting if we can figure out the logistics and make sure that we get a good Wi-Fi stream. We will also be adding new podcasts next year. At least two podcasts will be joining the radio network next year. There's a lot going on at the Solitaire Rose Podcast Radio Network. We would like you to join in, so go ahead, subscribe via Stitcher, via iTunes, via whatever system you use. Let your friends know. I also want to end the podcast by apologizing. I was unable to put this podcast out next week. I did promise that it would come out every 2 weeks. I missed last week because of work commitments and because of the sheer volume of podcasting I've been doing lately. That means that the next episode will be the week after Thanksgiving. I think it's kind of silly to put out a podcast the week of Thanksgiving when it would actually come out on Thanksgiving itself. So that's why I kind of made this episode extra long. We're going back to the every other week schedule, so in 2 weeks there'll be another episode. If you have any questions, if you have any ideas, if you have any comments, go ahead and email me at corey.strode@gmail.com. Subject, Novelcast. And we'll be back in 2 weeks for the next part of the story.